Where's Lance? Okay, okay.
Did we really give it to you on your birthday?
Yeah, that's brutal. That's brutal. Hey, you got to sleep in like 10 minutes, though, right? So it just depends on how you look at it. All right, Proverbs, shall we? Proverbs 23. For those of you guys that are going to go into the church world, employed by a church, this is one that you will no doubt have to deal with this issue if you're going to go into the nonprofit world, like I kind of live in day in and day out. This will also affect you, okay? You will deal with this at some point in your life. Many of you will deal with it in other aspects of life as well, but this is a great one to remember. Proverbs 23, 1 through 3. Somebody read that for us.
When you sit down to dine with the ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat. If you are a man of great appetite, do not desire his delicacies, for it is deceptive food.
All right, so some strong language here, okay? When you sit down to dine with the ruler, so we've got a dinner situation, and you are sitting down with a ruler. Paint this picture for me. What does this ruler have? Wealth, status probably, right? Power, most people that are in positions of great authority, at least in this day and age, and in ours as well, got there from some shrewdness, maybe some cunning, some ability. They are powerful people for a reason, okay? What is the advice of Solomon when you're in said situation as the non-powerful, non-rich, non-whatever individual in that situation? Don't eat his food, okay? Yeah, before that, what does it mean to put a knife to your throat? What's that? Maybe not so much that, but you're barking up the right tree for sure.
Refrain.
Be careful, okay? Don't just see with your eyes. You've got to see the whole situation. What's going on with here? Why is said ruler sitting you down and giving you a sweet filet or taking you to Ruth Chris and dropping some serious cash on you that you've never spent that much money on a dinner before? Why is this happening? Why is he or she doing this with you?
To butter you up
for? Steven, you're in the business world, I hope, or you just look really good every day wearing a suit and tie. At least you're honest about it.
I'm the shadiest one here.
Yeah.
So like pharmaceutical reps, you know, they'll take out people like and take them on vacations and all this crazy stuff, and that can really hurt clients.
For sure.
Because they're prescribing for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Man, back in the day, like it hasn't been too much, but pharmaceutical reps had like no rules. I mean, you could take a doctor, send he and his family or he and she and his family skiing in Vail for a week and spend $20,000 on their vacation and just write it off. Just hoping that they would prescribe your drug to patients. Which one are you going to, hey, do you want to take an all-inclusive, you know, ski trip to Vail or not? Yeah, my drug or their drug? Well, your drug, right? And that's, there's an agenda here. Now, not everybody that sits you down and says, man, I love you. I just want to bless you. Let's go out to dinner. I'll buy you a fat steak or whatever it is. That's not always the case. But what Solomon is saying is sometimes it is. And when you have something that person in power does not have, or you have the ability to open a door that they can't open without you, sometimes that steak isn't a free steak. Sometimes there is a hidden agenda behind it. And if you are not aware of that and you are so inclined and so desiring of what they have, you'll fall into that hook, line, and sinker, and they've got you. Okay, so especially in the world of nonprofits. I have been exposed to some of the most gracious, kind, generous people that I have ever been around in my whole life because of what I get to do day in and out. It is amazing. And 99.5% of the people that give to Off the Front, their time, their talents, and their treasures in the well as well, are those type of people. But there are the 0.5% that isn't their case. And they write a check with an agenda. They give their time with an agenda. Back in the church that Brad and I and Shay and Jared all kind of cut our teeth in Denton, Texas, There was a guy that came to the leadership staff there and said, hey, we want to bless you with this ridiculously awesome property. It would be like somebody saying in Fresno, we're going to give you 20 acres on the corner of 41 and Shaw to build you a church. And you're like, dude, that's the most coveted piece of land in Fresno, right? And they said, it's yours. It's yours to have. And they went and looked at it, and they all were like, holy cow, this is amazing. Well, they started doing some digging into this guy's background that was just graciously offering this piece of land. And it turned out, well, it wasn't just a gift. He was upside down financially. And it wasn't that he was giving it to him. It was that you were going to take over my payments on said property, which they said was about like the equivalent of 3 full-time staff members a month. So it's like, well, wait a second. This isn't actually you trying to bless us. This is you trying to unload your debt on the church. Thank you, but no thank you. Okay, so there are stories like that. Now, we're sitting in a building that was basically given to us, and there were some incredibly generous individuals, I have no idea who they are, in our church that said, man, we've had a great year business-wise. We want to bless the church, and we want to give you guys the opportunity to buy this facility when it came available. And they wrote a check and said, here, no strings attached. We love what you're doing. We feel like God's moving in this place. Do it, right? And that was an amazing gift, and there to this day, we're no strings to that. So be careful as you guys work in those worlds. If you're in ministry worlds, you are going to be faced with this. It may be money. It may be opportunities for advancement. It may be sweet perks on the side when, you know, you just take good care of my junior high kid and make sure that whatever. There are people that just have agendas, and be aware of them, okay? So as you think through that, if you are somebody with great appetites, that's the warning to Solomon's kid. Be careful and put a knife to your throat. Do not fall for those sorts of things. Do not desire riches and wealth and the things that rulers have, lest it cost you something greater than you think it does. It's not just a steak dinner that you're giving up in the process, all right? So thoughts on that from you guys as you kind of ponder what that means for you. How many of you, by the way, just have aspirations of, I say full-time ministry, I'm not a big fan of that word, but you know what I mean by that. Down the road, you think, man, I feel like God's leading me to go work in local church or a parachurch type organization. Okay, many of you guys I know are already doing that, so cool. All right, any nonprofit buffs in here? Really? Wow, you guys are awesome. Cool, good. Love it. So, note to all of us, cool? All right. One day you guys are going to have like some feedback for me and say something after I teach a proverb. But until then, we'll just keep going back to Genesis, and I'll assume that you guys are like understanding me and I'm not speaking German up here or whatever. So, all right. Very good. All right. Will somebody pray for us this morning? Do you mind? We're going to jump into Genesis 7 is where we ended. 7:1, I think, finished chapter 6 last week. Who would like to pray since I'm still learning names? Calling you, so maybe do it. Which McIntosh?
Kyle,
thank you. I'm learning. So I had the last name right, so that's a step in the right direction. Thanks, Kyle.
Dear God, for all these awesome people that would get to come and study your word so early in the morning, and I pray that we get the most out of our time today. Amen.
Amen. All right. Back it up. Genesis, okay? Theme is?
God.
It'll restart for the day. Put your head down, go back to sleep. Sovereign election. All right, that's our theme, okay? First breakdown of Genesis is what chapters? 1 through 11. They are called the planks. And then where do we go from there? Chapters 12 through 50 is the patriarchs, okay? Chapter 1 is about God. Chapter 2, thank you, welcome back. Chapter 2 is man. 3, sin. 3:15. Redemption, 4 through 5, civilization, 6 through 9, judgment, 10 and 11 is what? Nations, races, pagan religions, okay? You got most of the words in there at some point. Perfect, okay? We're going to finish, I think, the planks today, okay? So we'll walk through that back half of the planks, walk through that last piece. We'll finish up the judgment piece this morning, and then on into nations, races, and pagan religions, okay? So big picture, that's where we're at, okay? I want this drilled in your head. I want you to wake up at night in cold sweats, thinking about it, talking about it, okay? You don't know it until you can share it upside down on a napkin at lunch, okay? You with me? So make sure that you guys have that, okay? Anybody can walk through the text. It's the big picture stuff I want you guys to see in the flows of the how the text goes, okay? So we started last week the judgments, okay? Chapter 6, we saw the beginnings of the craziness that was on the earth, the sons of God and the daughters of men, and that weird piece. What the heck was that? The Nephilim as a result of that offspring, right? Talked through a couple different options of what that was. And we see God basically saying at the end of that dissertation, I am grieved. I am sorrowful that I've made man. We're going to destroy the earth. The floods are coming, right? Noah was his boy, 6 verse 8, the guy that found favor in the eyes of God. Again, not perfect, but there was something about Noah that caused God to choose him. This grace, this unmerited favor that we saw God kind of bestow upon him, all right? We saw kind of the outpourings of that, of God establishing his covenant, and how the kids, or the kids, the animals are going to come to the ark. Welcome to the world that I live in. Kids come to dinner. All right, in chapter 7, verse 1, now we're going to see kind of the outpouring of this and the beginning of how God is now going to bring judgment upon the earth and destroy ultimately the entire earth with a flood, all right? 7, verse 1, let's pick up there.
Said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and 7 pairs of the birds of the heavens also, male and female, keep their offspring alive on the face of all the earth.
All right, so Noah's already brought in, or God has already brought in all the animals, right? Twosies, twosies, you guys know the song. And then God says to Noah, bring in these different animals. What was the purpose? Why is Noah getting additional animals onto the ark? For sacrifice. When they get off the boat, Noah's going to offer sacrifice, okay? So God's instructed him to come. Now, this is funny, too. He and his household, by the way, you got, excuse me, Noah, his 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They are going to be very important, so remember them. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. 3 sons, okay? Their 3 wives, and then you got Noah's wife. So we got 8 people going onto the ark, okay? Noah, his wife, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives. We don't know any of their wives' names, but they are there. And then we got every animal, male and female both, and then additional animals for sacrifice. They get on the boat. In verse 4, God says, I'm going to put you on it. Then after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth. So Noah has to get on the boat, and then what does God do? Makes him sit there for 7 days before there's any water that comes from the earth or from the sky. So 7 days he's got to sit on there, okay? Verse 5, Noah did according all that God had commanded. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. So we're still seeing dramatically long lifespans. Now, after the flood, that is going to change significantly, okay? We're getting close to, I think Abraham's 120 when he dies. I mean, so we're we're certainly numerous generations away, but the lifespans of mankind are going to decrease dramatically, okay? So Noah gets all the animals 2 by 2. You kind of know the story. They're all on the ark. Verse 11 now, we see in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, on the 17th day of the month, the same day the fountains of the deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were open. So we see 2 water sources, if you will, of the flood. What were they according to this text? Verse 11. The fountains of the deep, okay? The season place, so maybe. What else could the fountains of the deep be? How have we watered the earth for this duration of time? Remember in the garden that God says it used to rise up like a mist from the ground? So something is coming up from the ground that's flooding it from the ground, okay? Yep.
Is that the expanse, the waters above, waters below?
Not yet, yes, but that's where we're going with the waters above. So the waters below, I think, are the God's automatic sprinkler system, and he just opens the valve all the way this time, okay, for days, 40, in fact, okay? And then the floodgates of the sky were what? Yeah, more than likely this vapor canopy, okay? You know, again, I'm not going to take a bullet for that, but there is some gigantic amount of water that comes upon the earth that is previously not there, okay? So there is a bunch of water. And we're going to see that every surface of land is covered on the entire earth. That's insane. Now, some have suggested that maybe this was a local flood. That's certainly possible. It seems like this is a worldwide flood. We were talking last week after residency regarding some of the other flood mentions in, what is it, Gilgamesh, thank you. And there's some other ones out there from other, thank you, you know, pieces of history or what have you. So most great histories that go back this far speak of some type of flood. God is, or Noah, or Moses rather, as he writes this, is aligning us to the fact that God caused this. It's his doing. It's an act of judgment upon the earth because of sin, and it is worldwide. Okay, so we see a grip of water so much so that it literally is going to cover the entire earth. Okay, now verse 12, rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So we get the rains from above. Now, this is the first time they've ever seen this, by the way. First time they've ever seen rain. That had to be a little bit distressing, I would imagine. Like, I'm from Texas. We have thunderstorms there. Like, we have real rain. Like, shake your windows, flood cars. Like, it's scary rain. You guys, if you're not from the Midwest or back east anywhere, you have never seen thunderstorms. You think you have. You just haven't, right? Y'all panic about tornadoes and stuff from California. We panic about earthquakes and think, why would they live there? And you think, why would they live there? This had to be a serious earth, like changing, shattering, distraught type situation that they were in, as that much rain is coming at once. Okay. Now God's going to go a little bit more, Moses is, into the description of the ark and how they get there. The ark is, by the way, a really cool picture of salvation. Okay. And it's just it wasn't written this way. It wasn't purposed so that we would understand salvation in the sense of what God's doing. But it's fascinating as you just look at some of the parallels as to what's going on. Okay. How did all the animals get there again? God drew them, right? They weren't, you know, Noah didn't have to go out and grab them and bring them in and, you know, rain them down and wrestle them, you know, hog tie them in 8 seconds or less and then bring them onto the ark. That wasn't how that happened. They were drawn to the ark, okay? Once they are on there, notice in verse 16 how they stay on there. Yeah, God shuts the door. Like, they get in and they are sealed in by God into this gigantic floating coffin, right? That is the only source of protection on the earth. So God shuts the door, seals it. They got a window up top. There's no mast. There's no rudders. There's no sails. It is a box floating on the water, right? That is it, divinely directed by God, okay? Notice in verse 20 and following. Eric, pick up there.
The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died.
Everything. So every land-dwelling creature dies. Now, you rewind the tapes a little bit and think about what mankind would have thought about Noah building this boat. There had to be some mocking. There had to be some, like, what in the world is this crazy nutjob doing? And then all of a sudden, the rains come, and then the seas are opening up, or the sprinkler system's opening up from the ground. There had to be a change of heart pretty quick. And not to be gruesome, but to see that and to hear that and to think about what would have been going on around Noah, watching humanity die, and then every animal as well. I mean, that is a very somber mood, very sobering. Okay, so it says in the text that all died. Now, the sea creatures and the marine life, they don't die, okay? But all land-dwelling, air-breathing animals die, okay? 23, he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animal to creeping things of the birds of the sky. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left together with those that were in the ark with him. The water prevailed on the earth for 150 days. So God brings the water, and that level stays for 150 days. So 40 days and 40 nights of rain and the sky opening up, 150 days thus far. And then in verse 1 of chapter 8, watch what God does.
But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided.
All right, so God remembers what specifically with Noah? What did God make with Noah? What have we been talking about?
Covenant.
God remembers his promise to Noah. I will take care of you. I will see you through this judgment. It's not that he forgot, but God is saying, I am staying true to what I promised to do. Not on the basis of Noah and his righteousness, because we're going to see that that's not necessarily the case with Noah. He is certainly not perfect. But God is making his promise true. Okay, the waters are now going to begin to recede. In verse 4, the ark rests on Mount Ararat. Okay, we have no idea by the way where that is. Some have suggested somewhere in Turkey or whatever. It's somewhere in the Middle East, but we don't know where. Okay, so if you find the ark, good for you. You'll make lots of money and get a Discovery Channel show named after you. Okay, but we have no idea where it is. There's no remains that we found. There are some Discovery Channel shows on that somebody found it, but nobody really knows. Okay, continues to decrease, and Noah in verse 6 says it came about in the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Okay, the ark again is a picture of salvation. Noah's going to send out two birds, a raven and a dove. And again, I think these are fascinating pictures of the salvation picture of the ark. Okay, first bird he sends out, verse 7, read about that.
He sent forth the raven, it went to and fro until the waters dried up from the earth.
Okay, stop right there. Okay. He sends out a raven. Okay, what type of bird is a raven? What do ravens eat? Dead animals. Okay, what would be on the earth at that point? A buffet, right? There are dead animals everywhere. So he sends this bird out, this fleshly bird that eats flesh, right? And it says in the text, and he flew here and there until the water dried up from the earth. Okay, does the raven ever come back to the ark? No. Why? His desire is what's out there. Okay? There is flesh. He's a bird of the flesh. That's home for him, right? He's like, sweet, buffet, lots to drink, lots to eat. It's a party. Okay? So he does not return. Okay? Then, verse 8, Noah sends out a different bird.
Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground.
So the purpose of sending out the raven was to find out, hey, is the water receded, right? Bring me something back that shows me that we, you know, can get out of this boat. Raven never comes back, so he sends a dove. What type of bird is a dove? How is it different from a raven?
It's not a bird of flesh.
Yeah, it doesn't eat flesh, right? It's not a carnivore. What is the, you know, dove eats, I don't know what doves eat, but not meat, right? So I guess they're vegetarians. So God sent, or Noah sends him out, rather, okay? Verse 9, keep reading. All right, stop there, okay? The dove found no resting place. Woo-hoo. Peter, what's up? No resting place for the sole of her foot, okay? What does Noah's name mean, by the way? Anybody got a note in their Bible? Did we not talk about it? I swear, it was in my head. It may not have came out of my mouth. Noah's name means rest or comfort, okay? So he sends out the second bird. What does this bird not find? No rest. No Noah. Literally, the roots of the two words in the Hebrew are the same. Okay, the bird goes out, finds no rest. So what does the bird do? It returns back to the father, to the place of rest. Okay, so she returned to him in the ark, for the water was on the surface of the earth, so there was no place for that bird specifically because of its nature to find rest, okay? Then he put his hands out and took her and brought her into the ark to himself, okay? What is the picture? If the ark is the picture of salvation, okay, and where one would find rest, you send out a bird that is a ravenous bird that eats flesh, and that bird doesn't return. And then you send out another bird that goes out in the same environment, sees the same stuff, has the same opportunities, but says, this isn't home for me, and returns to the Father. Somebody paint a picture for me. What are we talking about here? How would you apply that?
Law and grace.
Potentially. Okay. I'm leading you a little bit, and I'm not giving you a ton of clarity. You guys ever dealt with Christians that don't act like Christians? Have you ever met anybody like that? I know none of you are that way, and I'm certainly not that way either. I always act like a Christian, except when I make fun of Bree's coffee cup. Other than that, usually all the time, okay? We deal with people like that all the time. Sometimes our lives look like that, right? How can you tell if someone really is what they say they are? If you find someone that professes Christ and lives like crazy, what are you going to ultimately look at them and say, how am I going to know whether or not you're truly a Christian? What will they do? What will they not find satisfaction in? The world. They'll look at the world and say, yeah, there's parties and there's fun and there's all these temptations and things that ultimately are offering me happiness, and they're idols, and they're offering me fulfillment. And what do they not find in those? Fulfillment. So what do? They return. If they're truly a believer, they will return. Now, we don't know how long, we don't know how much, we don't know what their appetite is, we don't know when God is going to draw them back, but a true believer will come back, okay? What's the difference between that bird, if you will, and the raven? What does the raven find? Fulfillment. Rest. This is home, okay? That's oftentimes what I will use as a gauge in my life when my life looks like this, right? When I'm a dove in a raven's world and I'm trying to find rest, trying to find satisfaction and fulfillment in the alluring promises of sin that never satisfy. Is my heart inclined to come home, or am I finding rest in the things of the world? Okay, great measuring rod, I think, for all of us to remember that. If we are truly of the Lord, we will not find rest in those situations. We will ultimately come home. Okay?
Yeah, Max. It's interesting how it says, About the raven, it calls it an it, and the dove it calls it her. She.
Maybe there's some more relationship there. Yeah, I don't know.
So you don't know.
I haven't looked in the Hebrew of that, so no.
It's like a more personal. Yeah, like
for sure. That's a good observation. Okay, so. Just a side note, okay, sermon within a sermon there. So I don't know that that's why Moses wrote this for us, but it's always a fascinating picture to me of a measuring rod of a true believer that's living in compromise, okay? And all of us have seasons where we have done, will do, or are in various different stages of our lives, okay? So, and I've used this with folks that profess Christ, and I've shown them that. And said, at the end of the day, you're going to show me one of the two, okay? You're either going to come home and not find rest here, or you're going to find great rest in things that the world has offered, because that's who you are. Your nature has not changed. And it's one of the two. Okay, there is no plan C, okay? So, bird comes back. The dove ultimately comes back. Noah sends that bird out again, okay? Verse 12, and she did not return. Now, why did she not return? Verse 11, what did she find? An olive branch, signs of growth, God's blessing on the earth, the water's receding, and she's able to find a suitable habitat. So we see now trees, we see produce from the land, so God has now brought down the seas, and there is now rest in a right way for that bird, and the bird doesn't return, and Noah now realizes, okay, it is safe to get off the ark, God has brought the seas down. Verse 13, it came about in the 601st year, the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth, that Noah removed the covering from the ark, and look, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up, okay? He is in the ark for 377 days, just over a year. So, man, you talk about claustrophobic and smelly and just like ready to get off that thing. I can't imagine how confining that must have been, okay? God now allows Noah to get out, says in verse 15, go out of the ark, you, your wife, your sons, and your wives with you, bring out everything that creeps, take everything out of the ark. And then Noah in verse 20 is going to take now the animals that he brought with him, the extra sacrificial animals, and offer a burnt offering on the altar to God. Okay, now, again, this is all pre-Leviticus. We have not had instructions on offerings and what to offer, but you see this system is already in place and that God is pleased way back from Cain and Abel last week, that God is pleased with sacrifices. So this system is in place, that we have not seen it formalized with the law, okay? Watch this picture, okay? And anytime you think about sacrifice, this is what's going on in the mind and heart of God. Look at 21. Post offerings from Noah, this is what God sees.
And the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done.
Okay. So what does God say when he sees this sacrifice offered by Noah? How what is his response? It is a what to him? A soothing aroma. Have you guys ever smelled burnt flesh her burnt hair. It's filthy, and it is so distinct. It is pungent. It is like, oh, right? It is not soothing. It is not pleasing in any regards. How does God regard it? Why would he say it's a soothing aroma? What is it a picture of? Okay? At this point, yeah, ultimately we know the story. It's a picture of atonement, right? It's a picture of blood covering the sins of mankind. And that picture is a soothing aroma to God. The idea of one giving its life for another is the purpose of the Old Testament that we're going to see ultimately fulfilled in Christ, right? So this is a soothing aroma to God.
Where are all the dead people in it?
Everywhere.
So where do they go? What happens?
I would assume they decompose, and I don't know.
Like,
so.
Noah just lives with all these dead people around.
Yeah, I would assume, like, not in his camp or what have you, but yeah, I would assume on the earth there are plenty of decomposing dead. Yeah, fertilizer. Sorry. Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
it's been a year.
Yeah, I mean they're good and wet and bloated and but yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
gosh.
So
well, sea animals.
There you go. Maybe that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The whales were very happy. They don't just eat krill. So yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. Yeah, there is no cleanup crew on the backside of this thing. So that's the idea, okay? And now what does God say after he smells this? He says, I will never again curse the ground on account of man. Okay, this is, again, the beginnings of the Noahic covenant that we talked about. He says, again, in chapter 9, verse 11, I will establish my covenant with you. All flesh shall never again be cut off from the waters of the flood. Neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. So God is saying, now that you're off the boat, you're never going to see this again. So the next time you see it rain, don't wig out. Okay, I am never going to do what I did here again. So he's going to put a sign for Noah to see to make sure that he understands that. So the tendency obviously would be every time you see it rain, what? Oh man, wig out, right? It's going to, worldwide flood's coming. No, relax. We're just watering the yard, okay? It's cool, okay? Now, what does God say in regards to man's heart, 8:21? What has not changed?
The evil intent.
The evil intent. So has God weeded out all evil by saving 8 humans and a bunch of animals? No, the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy it. So he's saying there still is an evil. So this doesn't solve the problem of evil. What did it do? It contained it. It slowed it. It pulled the e-brake, okay? We're going to see the same thing happen in a couple chapters from here at Babel, in chapter 11. We're going to see evil run rampant again. And God's going to pull the e-brake one more time in a different way to slow the process of evil, okay? So God knows, hey, we haven't somehow given man a new nature here. We have not rooted out all sin. That's not what God's done, but he's dealt with. He has judged evil in the rampant evil that is on the intent of man's heart from his youth, from birth, and we're now at least in a slowing process of that unfolding of evil, okay? So chapter 9 now, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, same command after they got out of, or in Eden, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. So has God's command to them changed? No, they're still doing the same thing, which is what? Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. So scatter, okay? Go subdue the earth. You are stewards of the earth. You are the prominent piece of creation. Steward well, subdue it, be fruitful, multiply. Okay, now something's about to change post fall. What is it? Verse 2.
The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all of the fish in the sea.
Okay, so what is God doing in the animal realm regarding man? Yeah, specifically the top of the food chain, creating what in them?
Fear
of us. Now, why would God have to do that? Like, no offense to any of you, but any of you versus a lion, I'm betting on the lion, right? I mean, that's just good. That's good money, right? The idea is we're weaker, we're slower, we don't have defense mechanisms. You know, we don't have huge amounts of strengths. We can't run like a cheetah. We can't spray sticky things like skunks. I mean, we have nothing to defend ourselves. So God had to put the fear. We do have thumbs. These are awesome, right? Ask Rick Taylor.
Oh,
can tell Rick I said that. He's my buddy. Thankfully, he's not my boss still, so that's good. So, dang it. Right? So, naturally, we are not at good odds with other animals. So, God literally instills in them a fear of us, okay? Fascinating that he would do that, okay? Now, what else changes in verse 3? Yes, we can. Read it.
Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant.
Okay, so up to this point, what are they eating? Plants, right? Now what do we get to eat?
Meat.
Yes, okay. Praise Jesus. This is my favorite verse in the whole Bible right here. We get to eat meat. Okay, however, you shall not eat flesh with its life. That is the blood. Why would God say, okay, you can eat meat, but don't eat the blood? Because it's part of sacrifice. It's a picture of what? Atonement. It's important, and that picture is important. Okay, so you may not eat flesh with blood in it in that regard. Okay, so you shall not eat the flesh with its life. Verse 4, that is the blood. Surely I will require your life blood. For every beast I will require it. Okay, so there's a picture of God saying this is a sanctified picture. So I don't know if he's saying cook your meat or drain it for whatever, but don't eat blood directly. Okay, there are tons of folks that go into other countries as missionaries. And this is a normal part of some cultures that they drink blood. And missionaries have to make that really hard cultural decision. Do I fit in with them and drink the blood? Do I violate what maybe was in the Old Testament that's not necessarily in the New, but is really weird and gross? And, you know, so there are weird contextual things that some societies still do this today, okay? So thankfully, I've not been faced with that challenge. I'm pretty sure where I would land on that, but regardless, okay? Now, something else that happens after the flood that is also new. Read verse 6 and 7. Okay, so what is verse 6 talking about?
Murder.
Murder, right? So whoever sheds a man's blood, whoever murders another man, his blood shall be shed. What does that mean?
Eye for an eye.
Eye for an eye. Okay, what do we call that today? You're a murderer, what happens to you? You die? It's called capital punishment, right? So God gave, in this now new dispensation of government, this is how it's going to work. Okay, man is going to rule, in a sense, and if one man sheds another man's blood and kills him, that man will be put to death. So God has given to Noah and mankind the ability to shed another man's blood. He has instituted capital punishment. Okay, that's the idea. So eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. The punishment will fit the crime. Okay, 7 and following, as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Populate the earth abundantly and multiply. Okay, now, question. Did capital punishment end in the Old Testament? Or is this something that is still a biblical concept today?
That was for Israel.
Okay.
For
possibly, yeah. So this is certainly speaking to Noah, right? So maybe it wasn't intended for all the nations.
Isn't Noah all our father, though?
Yep. We're all going to come from him, right? It's Noah and his three kids. So yeah, we're all traced to him somewhere. And he's given the command to mankind at this point. Israel proper doesn't exist yet. So they will this morning, I think. Tomorrow will end Israel. But capital punishment in the hands of government, was that just a dispensation that came and went with God, or is it still around today?
Doesn't that talk about
it
in Romans?
It does talk about it in Romans. That's a great segue. Let's go there, shall we? Romans chapter 13. Paul's talking about government, okay? Now, if you got chapter headings in your Bible, this one says, in mine at least, in relation to government, okay? Every person, 13:1, is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, okay? For there is no authority except God, and those who exist are established by God. So what is God saying through Paul regarding all governments, all mankind's forever? Okay, you're subjected to government, okay? Paul doesn't say, do you like him, right? Did you vote for him? He says, be in subjection to him. Now, there is obviously a line there somewhere And we were probably closer to that line of subjection than we've ever been in all of human history in terms of obey, disobey. Okay, you're seeing that with, what's the gal in Kentucky, the Kentucky court that's not issuing marriage licenses. I mean, you're seeing issues that are flying in the face of some of our biblical values, and we're having to learn how to navigate those as a Christian society and where to go. Okay, so wherever you land on this Kentucky court deal, you're seeing people trying to wrestle between, this is what I believe, this is what I think the Bible says, and this is what government is asking me to do. Okay, so there's a line somewhere. Regardless, God says, I put in all government. Okay, does that mean all those governments are good? No, he says they're in subjection to God, and I put them there. I gave them the authority to rule. Okay, therefore, whoever, verse 2, resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they have opposed, those who have opposed will be, receive condemnation upon themselves. Okay, and here's why Paul is saying, make sure you obey government. Verse 3. Jacob, pick up there.
For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval.
What is that verse saying?
Those who do good don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. If you're not driving 85 down Herndon, then what do you got to worry about obeying the government, right? Drive 50, you're fine, right? Now, if you're going to be a loose cannon and disobey, you have need to fear government, right? If you're going to break the law, then you got an issue, right? If you're not going to break the law, it doesn't really matter, okay? Because in verse 4, if you're going to break the law, what? For it, this is government, is a minister to God, of God rather, for you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. Why? For it, government, does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. What does it mean in context for the evil person to fear government because government bears the sword to deal with evil?
God's given us all morality, so there's at least some sense that, I mean, I don't know how to put this, but a government would hopefully respond to immorality in a certain way, to do vengeance, and God, if God's over all of it,
yep,
it's going to be pretty good.
To what extent does Paul see government having the authority to deal with evil? How far can it go?
Death.
Execution. Does government today, in Paul's day, New Testament, the Gentiles have the ability to bear the sword? Yes. Is capital punishment still something that was present in Paul's day, that Paul says God has given that authority to human governments? And if it's speeding, it's one thing. Now, if you want to take that to the nth degree and you want to take another person's life, do you need to fear government? Yes, because God has given them the ability to take human life. Okay? So if you ask, am I a proponent of capital punishment? I would say, is the Bible a proponent of capital punishment? Yes. So, okay? I know all of you agree with me on this, so this will be easy. Andres, go ahead.
So, how does this play out with, like, if I'm a Christian reading this in the Middle East under, like, Sharia law,
yep,
they're bearing the sword,
yep,
as the government?
Yep. They are definitely bearing the sword as government. That's where I would go back and say, is all government good? Like, no. Do we look at Sharia law and say that's what God wants? It's absolutely not. I would make the argument that those are, that is not God's intent with that. And I think it's probably pretty clear in the scriptures that not his heart. That is not what he desires to see. That is an evil government after its own purposes. And they probably look at the fear of government in a very different way than we do. So, yeah. So I would affirm that. That's not God's heart. Yeah.
I feel like, or I see, and I have a question too. Wouldn't you say that the Romans and ISIS had, in relation to Christians, more in common than we're admitting, in the sense that you confess Christ and you will die? Because the Romans put people to death for saying that Jesus is God and Caesar is not.
Yeah.
In the same way that Jesus is God, period, you know. And so I'm just, so basically my thought is, we're going to quote unquote defend the Roman government here. How do we not at the same time say that God's purpose is, whatever is happening with ISIS, for some reason that is God's purpose?
Yeah.
If it's, you know, the increase of his church, if it's the zealous martyrs or whatever, but I don't know. I just...
Well, Rome also did a lot of positive things for Christians, and the fact that they lived underneath the safety of Rome, the Pax Romana, the streets, the clean water. I mean, they had a ton of things that Jesus would affirm. Look, pay to Caesar with Caesar. Like, you owe him something. He's given you stuff that's good. Now, give to God what's God's, and that's different. So I think even in there, there's a sense that, yeah, government's there. It's real. It is what it is. So give to them what they're due. They're not due what's due God, which is our worship. But I don't think this is speaking of Paul's not speaking of here a government that's going to...
A militant group.
Yeah, that's not the idea. So I think ISIS is very different. Now, did that happen in Rome? Certainly there were periods of time throughout Christendom where, you know, confess Christ and you're going to die. And I don't think that that's God saying, yeah, that's what I plan. That's what I want. That's my intent. I think it's saying in a normal... governing situation where there's not these extremes, that yes, the government is put in place to slow the process of evil. That is not what ISIS is. That is not what Sharia law is. That is militant. It's different. I mean, I don't know if I can explain it that well, but I think we get it on the surface. So does that help a little bit? So yeah, I'm not advocating for what's happening over there, but in a system where hopefully there is some sense of godliness in government and an acknowledgement of a higher power and a government willing to submit to that, they take that responsibility with great seriousness and understand that, yeah, there is a time and a place for when you take someone else's life, that needs to be dealt with. So I'm a firm believer in capital punishment because I see it as a biblical thing, okay? Now, I don't like it. I don't like the idea of taking other people's lives, but I think there is a place for it, and I think there is room for it in the scriptures, okay? Now, I come from a state that has a fast food line of, you know, in Texas of how we execute criminals. They don't mess around. So California is obviously a little bit different in terms of how they play that out and the process. So, okay? Yeah.
I keep saying that it's necessary to submit to authorities, not only because of the possibility of punishment, but also because of conscience.
Yeah.
And then in verse 7 it says, give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect.
Right.
And honor. So if we're coming back to maybe a ruling group like ISIS or an oppressive group like Rome, maybe then respect and honor are not what you owe them, but you owe them taxes.
Hmm.
Or you owe them whatever it is that they're charging it. And I know that for ISIS, there's been, you know, Christians being charged a tax for being Christian in that society. And so maybe in that case, what's owed to them is tax and not the honor.
Yeah, that's well said. Absolutely.
Kind of,
absolutely. I think there's a point where we are given permission to come out from the authority of government when they ask us to violate clear biblical mandates, which I think one of those would be worshiping Christ. Yeah, can we agree on that one? So I would say if a government ever asked us to confess Christ or obey us, I would say, I hope I would have the courage to say, I'm going to profess Christ, and I do not owe you, maybe I do owe you my taxes, but at that point, there's a very clear line in Scripture that says,
Yeah, and I mean, it says, then do what is good. It doesn't say, then do every single thing that they say.
Yeah. So, and I think sometimes we want to make that sooner than maybe the text allows for, in terms of when we don't have to submit anymore. Like, that's the million dollar, well, when do I don't have to do that anymore? It's like, well, not yet.
Yeah, I think it was just my only rub with it was in verse 4, where it's saying, well, that person, if we're talking about, you know, it's happening in the Middle East, he is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. So that's why I was confused, like, how that applies. Like, so is that person God's servant that's killing Christians?
Well, I mean, let's be clear that we're not talking about ISIS here, okay? This is not what Paul's discussing. In context, we're talking about Rome, okay? And we're talking about the idea that all government is put in place by God. So this isn't oh gosh, what the heck happened? Now we have Rome in charge. Who's ruling? Oh, I don't even know. God's saying, I'm sovereign. I know who's ruling. I put Caesar in Caesar's place. Do we see people underneath the authority of God do things that are outside God's known will? Absolutely. And that's not incongruent with what we see in Scripture. So no, I would not make the argument that God put that person in place to kill people that are professing Christ. No, I mean, that's a ridiculous argument. So which I think is exactly what you're alluding to. That would be ridiculous. Sorry, Hillary had a question.
Sorry, you might hate me for this one, but...
Hate the strong one. Probably not hate. I may throw my coffee in the bag.
Just being from Texas also and seeing the, like, super fast ticket system of capital punishment, it's something that I've always struggled with because it's so widely accepted there. And so kind of my growing up a little bit younger, so my politically correct mind that I try not to really have, like, where does predestination come in with that? And my mind is, I feel like it's about to short circuit because I feel like, who are we as man to take away years from someone's life that could potentially have them come to Christ?
Yeah.
But then also God is the calling and his timing.
Right.
And so my brain's just self-destructing right now.
Yeah, in the grand picture of God, there's nothing incongruent with that. So if someone is predestined to come, they're going to come. And they're going to come prior to hypothetically making that type of decision that would end their life. So that's not like, oh gosh, I predestined Hillary. Hillary murdered that dude. Hillary's got to die in an execution chair in Texas. I couldn't call her. That's not,
right.
Doesn't work that way. But I am a fan of that. I think sometimes we do wait too long. Now, you want to make sure that you're good and sure. Did that person actually do that? Are we putting someone, and that happened. So that's horrible. But to let someone live and pay their ticket for 25 years because we're too afraid to execute judgment upon them from taking someone else's life, like, they made the choice. They need to live in the consequences of that, which is why Paul's saying there needs to be fear. Like, if you're going to speed, you're risking a ticket. Be aware of that. So if you want to, go ahead, right? I about got my license taken away when I moved to California because I had 3 speeding tickets in Texas and couldn't get insurance. And it was like, poor choices, right? I got to live in that, right? That was my fault. It's not California's fault. It's not State Farm's fault. It's my fault. And the government had the authority to say, you don't get to drive here, or we're not going to insure you. And it all ended up working out, and I've driven really slow for the last 11 years and haven't gotten a ticket.
Is that how you got on bike for
me? Yes, right. That's why I'm riding a bike, yeah. Yeah. Was it a noble calling? It was a have to, not a want to. You know what I mean? So I those are congruent in God's mind. That situation would not unfold in the sovereignty of God. But I think that's what Paul's saying, because if you don't, what do you have? You're going to have a post a post-Genesis 6 society that goes crazy when evil is uncontained. We're going to see it again with Babel. That is, they can do whatever they want. Evil is at their grasp because there is no inhibitor to evil. And God says, we can't continue this way. Man left unchecked is going to go crazy, not with godliness, but with evil. So to slow the process of evil, that's the idea. I think it's part of God giving government to humanity.
Okay. So then, like, going back to the whole idea of capital punishment, how does that play out when, like, Jesus comes and says, well, you've heard about this governmental law of eye for an eye.
Yep.
I'm going to change it and say that doesn't apply.
Yeah. You've heard it say, but I say, yeah, Sermon on the Mount stuff, for sure. And I think there's a higher calling in the sense that he's asking, he has a different type of kingdom. But I don't think he's removed that. He didn't come to abolish the law. He came to fulfill the law. So he's not disagreeing with the law. He's not saying the law is abolished. He came to do the law and to show us the law in that regard. So I don't think he's saying, I'm taking this away. Now, there are certainly aspects of the law, right? I can wear polyester and cotton together, right? And I'm not sinning, even though Deuteronomy says don't. Right, that's part of the law, and there's other aspects of the law, right? I can shave my face tomorrow if I want to because I'm not underneath that covenant. But I don't know that there's a leaning in some circles that would say the Sermon on the Mount is lifted up above all other pieces of Scripture, and that is kind of the new gospel, and I disagree with that. I don't think that's what Scripture's saying. Now, I do think there's a sense that Jesus is saying, I have a very different kingdom, and we're to operate in it very differently. But I don't think Jesus would all disagree with capital punishment. So now we can ask him when we get there. But
so do you think that would be like more on an individual level then? I'm supposed to turn my cheek on an individual level rather than like on a governmental level? It's still eye for an eye?
I think certainly, yeah. And I think, yeah, are we supposed to forgive? Like, how far are we supposed to forgive? 7? No, how about 70 times 7? Yeah, like... to a maddening end, yes. Be gracious, like I'm gracious to you. So, yeah, I think that's a piece of it. But I don't think that negates what we read with Paul can't negate Jesus, right? If all scripture is God-breathed and the purpose of it is to teach, instruct, reprove for correction and training in righteousness, this all has to be inspired. And we can't have things that contradict if there's not, Jesus is not contradicting Paul. Paul isn't contradicting James with faith and, you know what I mean? It has to fit together. Or we're saying, no, this portion of scripture is better than what we've got. Okay, so one more comment that we need to keep moving.
The movement from the Old Testament to the New Testament, we were operating on a law of clean versus unclean in order to be like righteous for God, right? In the Old Testament, all of those like things like shaving your beard and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff. When moving to the New Testament, Christ fulfilled that, like he washed us clean.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're moving to the New Testament, that doesn't apply to laws of morality. It applies to the laws of like clean and unclean, not being able to eat certain types of meat.
Correct.
All of those things. Was that kind of what he was talking about just now? Was like the change of law from the Old Testament to the New Testament?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So are the dietary laws that are in the Old Testament still in effect today? No.
No.
Are the morality laws? Yeah. Now, they're not because we're under law, but we're under Christ who would support those in that sense. So, yes. So, there's certainly, I would use the word dispensations, where God reveals himself in different ways with different time. We are not in the Mosaic Law right now. We are prior to that. Noah is not required to obey the Mosaic Law. He doesn't know the Mosaic Law. Moses isn't here yet, right? So, in the flow of history, yes, God reveals himself differently, and there are different requirements for mankind in different seasons. Jesus is still the sum and substance of all of that, but yes, God is progressively revealing his character and his nature throughout time, and there are certain seasons where Moses' requirements are going to look very different than Abraham's in terms of how he responds in obedience to God. Does that make sense? But I see this as continuing. You guys can continue to wrestle with it, okay? But you need to be able to deal with texts like that and figure out what does God mean and what does that look like today, okay? Back to Genesis 9, all right? So, God says, at least at this point, eat meat, and if somebody kills somebody, you've got the right to kill them, okay? So at least we're, I think, in agreement, chapter 9, verse 6 and 7, that is what God's doing. Now, what, by the way, according to verse 6, is still around post-fall? For he is in the image of God, okay? Are we no longer image bearers? No, we still are. Now, is it the same way that Adam was? No, okay? My prof in seminary called it defaced but not erased, okay? We still bear the image of God post-fall, post-flood. Today, we are still image bearers of God, which is where, again, we get dignity for all humankind, regardless of race or religion or whatever they believe. Like, that is why we value life, regardless if they agree with us, okay? So someone that is a murdering, God-hating member of ISIS, they are made in the image of God, and our responsibility to them is to love them, biblically. Now, you can completely disagree, as I do, with their ideology and their belief systems and the God that they worship to the nth degree, right? But we are called to love them, okay? And that's hard, okay? Now, keep rolling. Verse 11, we see that covenant established again, that idea of I'm going to establish my covenant, the back half of 11, neither shall I again destroy the earth with a flood. So God says, no mas. However, to make sure that you guys don't wig out every time it rains, here's what I'm going to do, 12 and 13.
And God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth.
So what is God's, what is a bow? It's a weapon, right? So God is basically saying, I'm laying my weapon down, my bow in the clouds. Now, what do we know that is today? What is a bow in the clouds?
Rainbow.
It's a rainbow, okay? So by the way, that's our symbol, okay? Biblically, that's ours, which is very unfortunate where this is turned, okay? When we think rainbow, we don't see a sign of God's covenant grace with Noah to never destroy the earth again. We think in our context in 2015 in California, something very different, okay? And it's a bummer, but that sign's kind of been overrun. It means very different stuff today. But that was God's idea, okay? I'm going to show you grace so that every time after it rains, you'll be reminded, I haven't forgotten my covenant. I'm not going to do that again, so don't panic, okay? So God does that in verses 12 and following. And then verse 18, let's kind of see the rest of the story. Noah and his sons are off the boat, and here's what's going down. Pick up in verse 18.
Now the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth.
And Ham was the father of Canaan.
Okay, so we're going to see the Canaanites are going to be kind of the thorn in the flesh of Israel for the foreseen future, okay? And we're seeing them mentioned in the story here because of what's about to happen, okay? So three sons, they started farming in verse 19. Verse 20, Noah began farming and planted a vineyard, gets a harvest from his vineyard, makes wine. Verse 21, he drank of the wine, uncovered himself, or became drunk, uncovered himself inside his tent, okay? You need to know a little bit about this culture, okay? To display oneself in this culture, it's a high shame culture, very, very modest, far more so than the United States. That was just an act that you didn't do, okay? Modesty is a big deal. So he gets hammered, goes into his tent, and passes out naked, okay? That is what the text is saying. So that's our hero Noah, okay? The man that's righteous in the eyes of God, okay? Naked, hammered, passed out, drunk, okay? 22, Ham, the father of Canaan. Now, whether Canaan's around or not, we're not sure, but Canaan is Ham's son. Ham is Noah's son, okay? So Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers. So as he sees his father in this dishonoring state before God, dishonoring state before his family, what is Ham's response? Tells his brothers, okay? You get the idea from the context of what we're about to read. It wasn't like, hey, dad's dishonored himself. We need to go cover him. We need to do something to restore his honor. It's the idea of this is a gossip scene. This is an ungodly way to handle this situation. Okay, what should Ham have done? See also what Shem and Japheth are about to do. This would have been the right response. Okay, keep rolling in 23.
But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness.
So they literally put a blanket between their shoulders, walk backwards, and drop a blanket on Noah to cover him and to remove his shame, if you will. They don't revel in their dad's sin. They said that's not right. And you get the idea that these two brothers handle it differently than Ham. Okay, he's bragging, if you will, about his father's sin. And Noah, when he wakes up, realizes that, somehow gets this news. Now, this verse has been interpreted a gazillion different ways. It's a bit problematic in terms of what actually was Noah's sin, or what Ham's sin was, rather. Noah obviously is sin. Ham's sin is whatever. I think that's what it is. I think he saw his father's nakedness and was dishonoring the way he spoke about his father. And in verse 24, Noah woke from his drunken stupor. And in verse 25, this is what he utters now to Ham.
His brothers. He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant."
So one son gets cursed, two sons get a blessing, right? What does he say about Ham? He's going to be a servant. Okay, he was the youngest brother anyway, but he gets cursed. Okay, so he gets put underneath his brothers to serve them. Okay, Shem and Japheth both get blessed. 27, may God enlarge Japheth. Japheth means to enlarge. So he's saying, may God bless you. May your line be enlarged. Okay, and the God of Shem, let Canaan be his servant in verse 26. Shem means the name. Okay, Abraham is going to come from Shem in his line. Okay, so this is the line as we continue. We started with Adam. We've unfolded it now all the way to Noah. Noah has three kids, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem is going to be the line from which Abraham's going to come from. Okay? So we're going to see that now in chapter 10. All right? You with me? So he gets blessed. This kid gets cursed, and his line gets cursed. Okay? Now, the Canaanites died off long ago. Okay? There is no continuing curse of this, so there's not a fulfillment of that today, but this line gets cursed. And we know there is nothing but tension between the Jews, the line of that God's going to choose from Abraham, and the Canaanites, as they lived in the land, there was nothing but this, okay, constantly. So we're going to see that fleshed out as we continue to read through the text.
How do we know that the Canaanites are gone?
Because I read it from a smart kind of commentary. Is that a good answer? We just know that line's been extinguished. So, yeah, how they know that, I don't know. But it's there's no sense that continues today, okay? Now, chronologically, let's keep reading. Verse 28, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Okay, so Noah dies at the end of chapter 9. Still a wicked long life. Okay, we're about to see those again change now that the vapor canopy is gone. Okay, chronologically, chapter 10 happens after chapter 11. Okay, so Babel, chronologically, is the next thing that we're going to see. So we see a ton of development of societies. We're seeing movement and progression. And chapter 11 is the next thing, and we're going to see God do something with society, and 10 is the outflowing of that. So 10 is simply a genealogy. You see the outpouring of Japheth, of Ham, and Shem in all their lines, okay? So chapter 10 is very simply a genealogy of what happens. But chapter 11 is the ignition point of what started this and why God would talk about these genealogies and what comes from them, okay? So let's move to chapter 11, and let's kind of walk through what's going on now. So the question would be, did God's act of punishment to deal with evil in the flood, did that solve all problems? We obviously know the answer to that question. But in 11, we're going to see where this goes next. So chapter 11, verse 1.
Now the whole earth had one language and the same words.
Okay, so in context, what does that mean? One language. Everybody spoke the same language, okay? Our Jewish guide Ronan would say it's Hebrew. Okay, everybody speaks Hebrew at this point. Okay, I don't know, maybe, probably not English. I know that. Okay, one language. Okay, keep reading.
And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there.
Okay, where's Shinar? Babylon, somewhere. Okay, kind of that. That's the area. We're in the Fertile Crescent. We're still in the area we're talking about. What do you notice the people do in verse 2? Settled. We've seen someone else settle. What did God think about that? What was the command? Be fruitful, multiply, subdue. What does that mean? Don't stop and build yourself a big fat daddy city with walls and towers and say, look at me. This is exactly what Babel's doing, and we'll see that, okay? God wants them to be fruitful, multiply, and subdue the earth. So you're going to see in context that that is not what they're doing. They're not about God's commandments for them. So they're in Shinar, and they settle there. Now, of course, you got to settle at some point to have a camp or whatever, but it's going to go further. Keep reading 3.
And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth.
All right, so verse 11, or 3 rather, you see the building materials. I don't know there's much commentary on that. They build with what they have, but in verse 4, what is their motive? What is their purpose? Come, let us build for ourselves a city, a tower, okay? In Babylonian culture, their towers were called ziggurats. Rick's going to talk you through these next week, next Thursday. He's going to come in, and he's going to walk you through the background of Abraham. It's fascinating, mind-blowing stuff that I didn't get in seminary. I'm so mad. So literally, I sat in here 1 year and took like 3 pages of notes. So warm up your hand next Thursday before you come in. What Rick's about to drop on you, you're going to go, OMG. Literally, you'll do that. Their idea is to build for themselves a tower, a ziggurat. In ziggurats, what were the purpose of ziggurats, if you will, in Babylonian culture?
Show off.
Show off, and they were also places of worship, okay? So this is about them. And are they worshiping Yahweh in these towers? No. So you're beginning to see a change in what's happening. It's about them. Let us make for ourselves a name. So what are they about now? Are they trying to make a name for God? No. They're about making a name for themselves. Why? End of verse 4.
Lest we be dispersed over the whole face of the earth.
Okay, so they're afraid that they're going to have to continue to scatter and do what God's asked them to do. What would be the other natural reason you would stop, build a tower, build walls, settle, and kind of hunker down?
Safety,
because you're afraid of other people, other folks that are around you, and there's tension. So that's their motivation. So we'll build the highest, the best, the biggest. And their idea, the word Babel, by the way, in Babylonian culture, literally means gateway to God. It means something very different. It means blah, blah, Babel in our culture. Okay, so it means confusion. That's where the word Babel comes from. So it's got this kind of double meaning. So they think, wow, look at this great thing called Babel that literally is like a gate to God, a gateway to God, a city to God. And we're going to build a tower that's going to do what? It's going to reach the heavens. Like, son, do you see the arrogance in that? They have done the exact opposite of what God has asked them to do. They've settled. They've built a name for themselves, not God. And they are now not doing what God asked them to do. Okay? So God's like, uh-uh. Okay? Now the humor in this is in verse 5. They're going to build a tower that's going to reach the heavens, and watch what God has to do.
And the Lord came down.
The Lord what?
Came down.
Came down. Oh, I can't even see it. Let me go down and see their puny tower, okay, that's going to reach the heavens. Let me go down and look at it to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Oh, it's so impressive. Let's go have a look, okay? Verse 6, God says, keep going, Jacob.
And the Lord said, behold, they are one people and they all have one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible.
All right. Talk to me. What is this verse talking about? What's... God's making a commentary about this situation. What is he saying? This is important. He sees this issue of them building a tower and says they have one language. Nothing that they set out to do is going to be impossible for them. Is this a good commentary or bad? Let's start there.
Bad,
right? Because what is the intention of man's heart at this point? Evil. So this... one language, them having the ability to all speak one language and all understand each other, all of humanity, what is it lending itself to? Evil. And it's unstoppable. They can do it unbridled because that's the intention of their hearts, and it's easy. Okay, so God says, this is not good. Okay, evil is unchecked in a sense because that's the intention of man's heart. So God comes down, he sees this, and he makes that commentary. So verse 7, what does God do?
Come, let us go down there. Let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech.
Okay, so what is God going to do? He's going to confuse their language. He's going to make them Babel is where that word comes from, to confuse. So you think your Babel is great? It's a gateway to God. Your Babel is literally going to be Babel. So God, the Lord, verse 8, scattered them abroad over the face of the earth, the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. So they stopped focusing on themselves. They quit the building of the city, which again was a picture of evil unchecked, and God confuses their language. What does that mean? Did everybody just start speaking gibberish? No. What is the idea? They have a language right now, right? They speak, they understand. So when they say dog, you go, oh yeah, I know what dog is. That's a dog. And I say, cat, you mean that. Okay, one's good, one's bad. I know what you're talking about, right? And you all know which it is. So what does he do then when he confuses their language? He creates additional language, okay? You're speaking Russian. You're speaking English. You're speaking German. You're, right? So there are languages now. So I used to hang out with Adolf, and we'd speak Hebrew, and I'm speaking whatever God gave me to speak, and Adolf's looking at me like I'm nuts. Well, what are you going to do if you don't understand me? Who are you going to go hang out with?
Nobody who I do understand.
Everybody that you understand. And then what are you going to do? You're going to move away, and you're going to create pockets of people that you understand, and you're going to speak the same language. And that was God's idea. You're not going to scatter. I'm going to make you scatter. And you're naturally going to form pockets of people like, oh, you understand me. Janelle and I speak the same language. Fantastic. We're going to hang out, and we're going to get all the other people that speak whatever language that is, and then we're going to be together. That's the idea. So in that, we see a very clear idea that God confuses languages, that in that moment creates additional languages. Okay. What was the purpose of that again? To slow the process of evil. Okay. This is an act of judgment in some regards, but it's also an act of grace. Because God says, if I continue to let this go and don't check evil, what's going to happen? Anything that man can set their minds and hearts to. So this is an act of grace by saying, this is what's going to happen. Now, what else do we know occurs in cultures? When languages change, what else, and this is more inferred from the text than maybe what's clear here in terms of specific languages, but I would make the argument that this is where races come into the picture as well. in different races is not an act of judgment, nor was languages. It's an act of grace to slow the process of evil. Okay? Now, I don't know for sure. The Bible is not like crystal clear on where different skin tones came from, different races came from. We know they came from somewhere. Okay, it seems like this would be the point where those started. They all spoke the same language. More than likely, they all looked the same. They were all, you know, olive skin, Hebrew, dark hair, dark eyes type individual at that time. And at some point then, we got pasty white dudes like me. We got African Americans. We got them all, right, at this moment. And it's an act of grace. It's not an act of judgment. So different races and tongues are not bad. I think this is where God says it's an act of grace that we got them there. Okay, now, again, probably wouldn't take a bullet for that. What I want you guys at least to be able to wrestle with is the text isn't necessarily crystal clear on where that happens, but we do need to end up on the side of something other than chapter 4, where God put a mark on Cain, and that was an evil thing. So all races other than my race are evil and bad. Okay, that theology is no bueno. Okay, so this is where I would say I think this is an act of grace, and with the bringing of languages and people groups and possibly microevolution, if you will, that God allowed for that to take place here. Okay, so we obviously have now different languages that are going to develop into different races or nations, rather, as people gather together. What else are we already seeing in the text at ziggurats? Are they worshiping God? No, they're worshiping other false gods, idols. So we see pagan religions here as well. Nations, races, pagan religions is the outflowing of chapters 10 and 11. Okay? So we're already seeing man with the tendency to deny the creator, to reject the creation, and to worship other things, other not gods. Okay? So that is inbred into us because of our sin already. Okay? Yeah.
So where do we see that ziggurat was like idol worship instead of just trying to get, like you were saying earlier, trying to get closer to God, the gateway to like getting closer to heaven, I guess?
I think if you saw the rest of the context of it being positive and God not coming down and destroying what they were doing, everything in context of what they're doing is anti-God. And then understanding a little bit of the background of what they did at those ziggurats in Babylonian culture, they're building a church building to go worship a different god. I mean, it's that type of clarity in terms of the context. So Rick will do a much better job than I can walking you through that history, but I think it'll become very clear that this wasn't just some, they're not building a FedEx Kinko's. This is not just some random building, okay? This is not a, we want to get closer to God. Let's build a tower so that we can touch him and feel him. Right? That's not what this is. Okay? Make sense? So, chapter 10 again. We won't read through all this, but this is the outpouring of Babel. Okay? You get different groups of people, different, literally, nations, okay, that come from that. Shem, Ham, and Japheth each have a line, and Shem is going to be the line, again, that Abraham and his lineage is going to come from. Okay? Does that make sense? So, that's where we're at. So, chapter 11, verse 10, we'll pick up now on the descendants of Shem. This is his line, okay? We won't read through all these, but I do want you guys to see kind of where Abraham's line is going to come from. Okay, look at verse 24, and we're going to pick up there now with kind of the end of all this and kind of where Abraham's line picks up. Look at verse 24, pick up there.
Nahor had lived 29 years, he fathered Terah. And Nahor lived after he fathered Terah 119 years and had other sons and daughters. When Terah had lived 70 years, he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran.
Okay, so there's our boy Abram. Okay, Abraham, as we know him, Abram's there. So Nahor is his grandfather. Nahor has Terah, and he has three sons, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Okay, so those are the kids that Terah has, right? Pick up now in verse 27, and let's see God's dealing with this family, this line from Shem.
Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans.
Okay, so Haran dies. This is Abraham's pops, okay, in Ur of the Chaldees. Okay, we'll look at this in more detail tomorrow. I'm going to show you guys some maps, but for sake of time, we'll wait till tomorrow. of kind of where this is and what's going on. Okay, they are way east of the Promised Land at this point. Yeah.
Did you say Terad?
Haran.
Okay. So it's not Abram's dad. It's his uncle.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Haran dies in the presence of his father Terah. Okay. In the Ur of the Chaldees. Okay. Abraham now, verse 29. Pick up there.
And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah.
Okay. So this is Sarah that we know, Sarai. Okay. So they both have different names at this point, and we'll get into why that is and what ultimately happens. So you've got Abram and Sarai, okay? Sarah was, verse 30, barren. Okay, remember this. This is God's, we're going to see this consistent with every people that God is now going to continue to choose, that they are barren. So God's going to form a nation from a couple that can't have kids, okay? So, yeah, God, right? And we'll see why he does that, okay? 31, keep reading. I think Ronan would say Terah based on, I've always called him Terah, but it just sounds like such a girly interpretation of his name. So I like Terah better. Let's go with that. That's more Hebrew. That's the emphasis is on the end of the word. So that's how they would say it.
Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran.
All right, so Terah takes Haran's son, Lot. They now leave with Abraham, his son, and their family, and they go to where? Verse 31, where is their destination?
Ur.
Okay, they left Ur to go to Canaan. Okay, Canaan is Israel. Okay, that's the Promised Land. Okay, I'll show you maps tomorrow. And on their way, they end up in where?
Haran.
Okay, they stop in this city, and they settle there. Okay, the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah dies in Haran. So on the way to their journey into the Promised Land, Abram's pops now dies in Haran, not where they want to be. Okay, not where ultimately God had asked them to go. Okay. And we're going to kind of walk through the reason and what's going on behind the scenes. So God is now calling this guy, by the way, Ur of the Chaldees is in Babylon. It's in the area that we were talking about earlier with Shinar, and that specific, it's Sumer specifically, but kind of in that area, right? So God has now called Abraham out of here, and we're going to see that call in chapter 12 as to why they left. We're also going to see it in Acts chapter 7. As Stephen gives a discourse of like Israeli history, or Jewish history, if you will, and what's going on. So these guys leave home. They leave a place that is hundreds of miles away from the Promised Land, from Canaan, because of something that's going on in Abram's life. Okay, in chapter 12, verse 1, here's what God's doing. Okay, this is why in chapter 11 they now left. This is what Abraham heard. 12, verse 1.
Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
I mean, that sounds pretty cool, yeah? God personally speaks to you, promise you all this cool stuff, and again, we'll go into the detail of what this cool stuff is tomorrow, and it's like, man, you're going to be a blessing. There's going to be, like, this sweet land that you're going to be in. I'm going to take care of you. Those that bless you are going to get blessed. Those who curse you are going to get cursed, and in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Abram, you're about to be a really big deal, okay? Now, we saw in chapter 11 the beginnings of this idea of other places of worship, other gods that are worshipped. In Abram's day, he lives in a very polytheistic society, okay? There are many gods, okay? So think Rome, think Paul's day when he's dealing with the pantheon and all these gods, and if you're not sure if you got them all, then you make an altar to an unknown god just to make sure you could possibly cover them all. That's Abraham's day. And then God speaks to this dude, our God, that these people, and again, as Rick walks you through this, it'll just, you'll add some backstory to this, don't know, they don't worship. They worship a moon god in their land in Sumer. Very different picture. And out of this idolatry, out of this false worship, God calls this dude who is immersed in pagan idol worship. And Joshua even goes so far to say that his pops, Terah, is an idol maker. Like, he's the dude that makes the statues that people bow down to, okay? That's Abraham's family, okay? Idol worshipers and idol making dudes. And God speaks to this guy and says, I want you to leave home, everything you know, and I want you to go to this land that you've never been to. And he, it seems like, audibly speaks to him, okay? And Abraham in verse 4 does what?
So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran.
So how does he respond to this call of God in his life? Man, that's insane. I mean, this isn't a God that you've worshipped all your life that you're, you know, asking to speak to you, or maybe in our context we would think that. This is a God that Abraham has very likely never heard or never mentioned. His family, his culture all worships different gods, and this God speaks to him and says, I want you to do this. Can you imagine going to have that conversation with your father? Hey, Dad, God spoke to me. Which God? This God that you've never heard of before. What does he want us to do? He wants us to leave home, sell everything, right? Leave all of our, everything that's familiar and comfortable, and go to this place that we don't have relatives, we don't have anything. We're going to move halfway literally across the country at this point, and we're going to make a new life for ourselves based on this guy's call in our life. And Abraham responds in obedience and goes, okay? So more to the backstory of that tomorrow to kind of set us up for where we're going. This is chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, are some of the most important verses in your entire Bible, and you're going to see Abraham here obviously respond in incredible obedience. Okay, so now as we're wrapping up the planks, now we're getting into the patriarchs, our first father, Abraham, and we'll, again, unpack his life a little bit more tomorrow. All right? Questions on that as we're kind of wrapping up? Yeah.
I saw a homework assignment said teaching the planks. I'm curious, is that like due tomorrow, or is that going to be assigned?
Yeah, totally due tomorrow. Let's talk about that tomorrow. So no, it's not due tomorrow. Okay. Yeah. Did I forget to mention that? Yeah, it's due tomorrow. Yeah. I'm sorry. Cool. All right. So bless you guys. Have a great day. We'll see you bright and early in the mañana.